To start with you, Abby, I wanted to know how I was wondering about your experience finding proof of your existence through ancient texts.
That's a heavy one. Is this working? Okay, good. First, thank you, everyone. Thank you, Haley and Cyrus, for being here, for inviting me. Thank you all for being here. Thank you all for being, which is another thing that I think we don't thank people enough for. And I will talk a bit more about that in a minute. It's a very heavy loaded question. Because personally for me, for a long time, I had something that one of my teachers calls post-God traumatic disorder, where you come from a very, like, where I grew up, God was the boogeyman in the sky, and anything that was divine or religious was the rock that was used to throw at you and the way to keep you in check. And for a long time, I wasn't interested in finding anything in text. I'm good. I'm done with religion. I'm done with our traditions. I'm done with our culture. I'm going to go my way. And the shocker was that didn't really work. It's apparently hard to take 20 years of your life and throw it out the window one day. It just doesn't really work. But I also came to learn that there's a lot of things that I enjoy. There's a lot of experiences that I really enjoy. And also, I went through about 5 years or so of studying focused on getting my rabbinical degree. And I know there's a joke that there's nothing that can turn you into an atheist like going to seminary. But ultimately, I really love and enjoy text. And I have a lot of friends who also grew up in religious communities who don't want to have anything to do with Judaism or with any religion anymore, and I totally understand that. I don't blame anyone. But a lot of times I have to, these people would be like, why are you doing what you're doing? Why do you care about these? And we'll maybe hand them out later a bit of the work that I've done. You can see it more online. I love to explore the text. I love to mess with the text. I love to take it and twist it upside down. But I love to look at it and to work with it and see how we can relate to it. And I always argue that we should give it at least as much appreciation as we do to any ancient text. And I like the way you framed it also as an ancient text. So, sorry, that was my very long intro to before I can answer your question. Now, I found several things. The first thing that I ever found was actually when I was 15 years old. And I was doing something that I wasn't supposed to do. I was studying Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism, which, depending where you come from, some people say you have to be 4 years old, or at least you have to be married. You weren't supposed to study it. And for me, that was kind of my, I guess, my kosher rebellion. It wasn't as bad as going on the internet, God forbid, but it was still a rebellion. And there was a text that's actually, I think I quoted it also in here, and some of you will be able to see it later, which is literally just like the one paragraph that says, "If sometimes a man may reincarnate into the body of a woman." It's a text from Rabbi Isaac Luria, known as Dari, which means the lion. He's the father of modern Kabbalah. He lived in the 17th century. And that was kind of the beginning of opening up a world where gender, and later on sexuality, but at that point for me what was really important was gender, seemed to be a lot more fluid and a lot more open than the black and white picture I grew up with. And as I was doing this more and more, I started realizing that it's not just that I can find text to justify myself, because I don't think we need that. And I'll be very cautious of saying that. I don't think we need a religion or a text or any law book to justify our existence, to justify us being who we are. But it's fun. It's a way of looking at it and celebrating it. And then it's also part of it is just the human part of it. Looking at it, I think that's very similar to art to some extent, where sometimes it's just a way of relating to it. And I'm like, here's this thing that I've been going through since I remember myself. But apparently there have been people for thousands of years, as far back as humanity's consciousness goes, that have been grappling with that. And I just think that's beautiful. Does that answer the question? I feel like I've been rambling on and not even answering your question.
I wanted to ask you also if, even in you stating that we don't necessarily need texts or ancient texts to justify a trans or a gender nonconforming or an intersex existence, I am really curious how going back into those texts changed your experience of your own embodiment, and if it did change your experience of your own embodiment.
It definitely did. And it's another one that I will be focused a lot on tonight, but I have online, and I can give anyone who wants, at the end, we can give the link to that for anyone. I have a whole kind of a curriculum, a lot of research that I've done trying to find not just texts or stories that, quote unquote, justify our existence, but rather ways of celebrating it. And I think I do have maybe a bit more. We'll get to that later. It has changed that in a very strong way. For me, it went from being, this is who I am. Don't try to change me because my parents tried for 20 years and failed and no one is ever going to succeed in that. I'm very comfortable and proud of who I am, to a point of, but oh my God, look at these. This is giving me a way. This is giving me a medium of celebrating my identity. And a big part of it is, going straight to the point, the naming part, which for me resulted in a naming ceremony. I did, after I transitioned, I came out, went very public about it. And then after a few months, I was like, I want to do something formal or cultural or maybe religious. And unfortunately, there wasn't something set in stone. If you open up a Jewish prayer book, or for that matter, any prayer book of any religion or culture, there are ceremonies for birth, for death, for weddings, for divorce even in some places. You get ceremonies and rituals for everything. There was nothing. I couldn't find any set in stone rituals. There was here and there a few blessings that I found online, but it was no set ritual. So I sat down and we did that. The whole ceremony, the whole thing is available online for anyone who wants to look it up. It's on YouTube. It's under the title, The Celebration of Life and Transition. And we did a full ceremony that went from singing songs to being called up to the Torah, which is like where we read the Bible, and doing the same ritual naming ceremony that we do for babies. And for me, it was, did I need that to justify my identity? Not at all. But it gave it such a richness and made me feel at home in a community that is, to some extent, similar to the community I grew up in.
Do you feel like you have a duty coming from a historical lineage of rabbis and a direct, you know, relation? Yeah.
That's a tough question. I don't know if anyone picked up on that, but the Hasidic community, who here knows anything about the Hasidic community? Am I allowed to do exercise for the group?
No, you can do that, yeah.
I can do whatever I want? Okay. Let me get like 3 to 5 volunteers. What do you know? You all live in New York, right? It literally has the most Hasidic Jews of any place in the world. There isn't a single city in the world that has more Hasidic Jews, not even in Israel. We have the most Jews of any Hasidic Jews of any city in the world. So, what do you know about Hasidic Jews? Anyone? Raise your hands. I'm not gonna move on until I have at least 3 people. Come on. You've all watched movies. Come on. Yeah, that's a holiday where people drink a lot, unfortunately. Maybe a bit too much. It's kind of like a mix of, let's say, Halloween and what other holiday would I give for Purim? I don't know. Halloween is the closest thing. Yeah, that's a holiday. I'm referring specifically to Hasidic Jews. So the Jews that you might see, like, who dressed like in the 18th century, the man have curls on the side and the woman shaved their heads, which you wouldn't see because they wear wigs or headscarves on top of that. Oh. Yeah, for the sake of tonight, we can all leave it together. Yeah, yeah. But yeah, valid point, yeah. Depends who. I wouldn't talk to Krana, to the whole different ball game, and I don't think we're gonna go into that right now. I personally grew up in Williamsburg. Yeah, we can talk about that later if you want. Yes. That is very accurate. Yeah. That's all accurate, though it almost sounds like you're describing a cult, but we can talk about that in a minute. Okay. Anyone else?
Well, I still have a dollar that I got from.
Yeah, that's Crown Heights again. Let's put that on the back burner for now. Okay, the reason why I wanted to do that also because I know most people in my experience, what they know about Hasidic Jews is what they see in the movies, which are usually extremely stereotyped, wherever it's about the Diamond District, as if all of the Hasidic Jews work in the Diamond District, which they don't, and a few other things like that. One of the things that is a bit less known in my experience is the Hasidic community runs like a monarchy. They've been about the same 10 families who've been in control for the last 150 to 200 years. The same families that go from father to son, and they all marry each other. So pretty much all Hasidic leaders in the world today, which they are more than leaders, they are supreme leaders. They control everything. They control the political life, the financial life, of the community. They are kings for all intents and purposes. And they also live like kings. They live very lavish lives. So all of them are by now related. And these families are considered, it's like a big deal. It's like from the second you were born, since I was 3 years old, I had a different dress code so everyone could recognize me from, I don't know where, that you belong to. Like it's a status symbol, but it's more than that. You're supposed to be trained from a really young age to be a leader because you have a holy soul, because your great, 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 whatever grandparents was very holy, was obviously very good at bringing down good holy souls or something like that. I'm not going to go into the whole philosophy surrounding that. And there's obviously a lot of, or no corruption whatsoever when everything stays in the family. As we all know, nepotism just works really well. And anyway, so like for me, that was something that was there my entire life. So it was almost natural that when I left, first of all, I couldn't do it quietly. When I left my community, I just wanted to go my way. But then everyone in the community was talking about it because everyone knows who my father is, even more who my grandfather is and who my family is, and it was more of a big deal. And then when I came out, the biggest reason why it blew up, and I've been like probably work with every media network, it had nothing to do with me, I'm nothing special. It's a radical story, and you look at my before and after picture, it's not just a before and after visually male versus female picture, it's this person dressed in 18th century clothes to a woman dressed in modern clothes, and it's a very radical example. So I wouldn't say as much as I felt a responsibility, as much as I felt an opportunity, a way of exploring that and making something positive out of it. Also, if I talk too much, shut me up.
Well, I guess we can turn to Cyrus for a sec. And I wanted to know more about your book project.
What Haley is referring to is I've been working on a book for the past 2 years. It's called A Year Without a Name. And when I started it, I had a different name, and it wasn't even on my radar at that point in time. When I began writing that, by the time I finished writing, I would have a different name. And the way that I wrote the book was through a really kind of just day-to-day journaling practice. So I have this kind of document of my experience of moving from one name to another, and within that, experiencing months and months of feeling, I guess I would say, nameless, and having moved from this point when I knew that my former name was no longer something that could contain me, to not yet having located a new name that I felt could beckon me into the next chapter of my life. And while I didn't grow up in ultra-Orthodoxy, I would argue that our culture in many ways does have an Orthodox relationship to naming, irrespective of whether you grew up in a religious community or not, and irrespective of whether you grew up in a community where people see themselves as having acceptance around transitions, be they, you know, gender or sexual or name-based transitions. And I think that I would definitely say that for me, the act of renaming myself is unequivocally the most spiritually nourishing and intense thing that I've been through in my life. And it made me feel connected to deep, deep forces of birth and creation and death even in ways that I hadn't felt prior. And I think a lot of that is because to change your own name. And I'm really curious to hear from Abby after I speak a little bit about this, what you see in this act of renaming and naming as an act of creation that is something universal that kind of extends beyond the specifics of what it meant to leave the community that you were born in. But it's so, so hard it's been so hard for me not to experience renaming as almost this kind of like cut because of what are the beliefs that we're told about what it means to be given a name and the way that being given a name also comes with these expectations of loyalty to family, loyalty to history, loyalty to tradition, and what it means to change your name and the sort of stance that you have to take about personal autonomy and self-determination. And that for me, changing my name was also something that in how much it created the space for me to move forward, it also was hugely about loss as well. And kind of releasing my past and releasing parts of myself and releasing, and also it brought up a lot of questions of betrayal. Was I betraying who I'd been? Was I betraying the name I'd been given? And I began to almost see the version of myself that I was denaming, unnaming, as someone that I was letting go, in a way that was as intense or more intense than any heartbreak or I've ever gone through. So, yeah, I think that for me, I can't think about naming without thinking about everything, all the expectations that come with it. And as I said at the beginning, I do think that it's its own form of orthodoxy that we're all kind of up against or breaking out of when we make the choice to recreate ourselves.
It's actually really interesting that I don't think I've ever heard anyone put it as eloquently as you did, but in general, the fact of like feeling that you don't have a name. Because like for me also, when I started being active physically, like actually go to like support groups, and that was months before I even came out, I was at a point where I obviously didn't want to use the name that I was using publicly at that point, but I wasn't really sure where I'm going, so I used my last name for a long time. Thankfully, my last name was something, and I know not everyone feels comfortable with the last name, but for me, that was something that I felt comfortable with. And it was this weird experience that sometimes felt good and sometimes bad of sitting in a group of people and introducing yourself, just using a name, and my last name is Stein, which is very obviously a last name, and people kind of know it, at least around here. And it was this nameless, almost this nameless time period, which was also interesting, though, because I've been active online on social media and in forums within the trans community since 2012, which was 3 years before I came out. And online, I felt very comfortably. I was using mostly Eve, or the Hebrew version of it, which is Chava, and I was feeling really comfortable with that. But then when I tried using that in real life, and I guess you would relate sometimes to that experience of like having that name just doesn't feel right. And I tried using that, and I'm like, nah, it doesn't feel right. Yet I already had a connection with that name, which is the other weird thing, because I did feel a bit of the betrayal part. I had this conversation with my father once, which was, so my father's a strong believer in, and it's a teaching from some mystic, a mystic teaching that the name is your soul. And when you call someone by their name, you're calling their soul. Not going to go into all the details, but he believes in that such a strong way that all of my siblings, and I have 12 of them, were called with our full name. And for most of us, that was two names. And my older sister has three names. And we were all called by our full names, not just when we were in trouble, but always. Because he believed that our full name is like how you awaken someone's internal soul and who they are. Which I guess is a very strong, I didn't even think about that, how strong like that, I guess, like, and it's very similar to what you were saying also. We all grow up with that. Our name is who we are. And supplement soul with our inner conscious, with our psychological existence, and it is who we are. So for a long time, I I disregarded that name that I used for a while, that I had a connection, but then also, sorry, when I was getting to, when I grew up with two names, and when I left my community, I started only using one name. And my father had this long conversation with me, how he feels like I'm angry on him almost. Like, are you not happy with the names that I gave you? Like, why do you have to, like, find a different way of saying it? And to me, it was like, I don't feel comfortable with it that way. I want to do it this other way. So that was like a similar experience, like after like transitioning. And I think, again, there's something that we can all relate. And I know a lot of people who just choose different names to use. Sometimes it's a middle name or a different way of pronouncing the name when they get older. And for me, so that was for a while. In the end, maybe we'll talk a bit more about it. In the end, I ended up choosing a totally different name, which is Abby and the Hebrew version of it. But I still kept Eve as my middle name, just because I had this like weird connection to it. But at the same time, didn't want to keep it as a first name, even after using it for such a long time. So it's a very, very interesting experience. And yeah.
I love what you said about, or I guess it's what your father said about this idea that a name awakens you.
It's a bit of, anyone a psychologist here by chance? I think it's a psychological fact that like names, I know a lot of times when people are in coma or stuff like that, doctors will say, like, name does do something to people.
So this is feels related to me. This summer when I got top surgery, I got a double mastectomy, and I was coming up from anesthesia. I was in the recovery room, and I heard the nurses saying, Cyrus, you're in recovery. Cyrus, you're in recovery. And I had this – I was still, like, under, but something about the experience of the surgery had taken me to such a kind of young or almost infant place in myself that I actually, in my half awake state, said to the nurse, oh, I need you to call me my old name, and asked her to say my old name, which was Grace. And because I just had this feeling of knowing that I would only be able to wake up in that specific moment if they kind of summoned me with this earlier name from my life. It's good when you talk. I think we all like it.
are there any specific verses that?
I mean, so let me. I will repeat kind of what I said during my naming ceremony, which is online. And at the handouts, are we going to hand it out to everyone, this, at the end?
We have handouts at the end, if you're interested, okay. That Abby compiled that speak to gender.
To transitioning ceremonies. But one of them is going to be a longer quote from an interview that I did with Huffington Post right after I did that kind of transition ceremony. And so, like, on there also, and it's the whole, like, it's a half an hour of me rambling on online. So if you want to, after tonight, if you're not bored of me yet, you can check it out. What's interesting to me, so the name that I ended up going with, which ended up being Abby, which comes from the Hebrew Abigail. In the Bible, Abigail is one of King David's wives. So has anyone here studied a lot about King David, like, Book of Samuel, Kings? Okay, so he has a very, let's put it this way, even my community was very uncomfortable with his sexual exploits. There's the story where he saw a woman on the rooftop as she was bathing, called her over, ended up having sex with her. She got pregnant, so he sent her husband to the front in a war, so he should be killed, so he should be able to marry her. And then a prophet came and told him that because of that, the kid that they're going to have together is going to die. Very long story short, that woman ended up being King Solomon, who took him over, ended up being King Solomon's father. And according to tradition, in Judaism, Christianity, and in Islam, both of these, King David and King Solomon, were prophets. So I think like when people try to use religion as an excuse always to complain about sexuality, it's usually BS, because at least in the Bible, the religion is very interesting. But anyway, so Abigail in the Bible, in tradition, is considered, according to the Talmud, which is a rabbinic text that was written between the 2nd century BC until the 6th century. She's called two things. She's called the most beautiful woman to have ever lived. One of the four most beautiful women to have ever lived. And she is considered one of the seven women who were prophets. And I think she is, I don't know about Christianity, but she's also considered a prophet in Islam. Which is very interesting. And for me, I was like, yeah, maybe it will rub off a bit, at least the beauty part. Didn't work, but hey, I can try. But to me, it was something that I related to. And I think it's the biggest experience that I've had with naming, and I get the feeling that you would relate to that, and hopefully other people, is that it has to feel right. And to me, it felt the relationship, also what it means. It means in Hebrew, the source of joy, source of happiness, which is really amazing. And then it was the simple, humane way for me. For me, it was a name that could be Hebrew, but the name that is used for it, which is Abby, which is also my legal name, doesn't scream Jewish. It doesn't give away my background as opposed to my name from before, which I'm not going to say, but whatever. It was the perfect of like, it's still who I am. I still feel like I have a way of relating to this, but at the same time, it doesn't give me away when I don't want to. Not that that played any role in it, but most of the time, Starbucks doesn't mess it up. They still manage to mess it up sometimes, which is impressive, but most of the time they don't. It was an easy name that felt real. And then I went with my second name, which is in both, in legally and in Hebrew. It's Chava, which is the Hebrew for Eve, which at the same time is also my great-grandmother's name, which is a whole separate experience for me of using my name as a way. In one way, it's creating my own identity, and in a big way, rejecting my background, but at the same time, trying to hold on to it in one way or another. Now I'm terrified of what a psychologist would say to that. I'm like, holding on, but rejecting. She's just conflicted, aren't I? Okay, I'm joking. Yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking about, there are so many people in my life, I feel like, who aren't brought to life, who aren't brought to life or aren't awakened by their birth names, by the names they've been given. But because that's not even, for so many people, a thinkable change to make, that what seems like it would be such a sort of natural and obvious thing to do, which is to, at a certain point, rename yourself with a name that actually does kind of call you forward and make you awake to life in a certain way, is so off limits. And is seen as such a cut and a break.
I'm also wondering, just in your life now, what do you still connect to traditionally? That, I mean, you talked about having this new renaming ceremony, but like in your daily life or in your weekly life, what still kind of gives you comfort and? Yeah.
So I had one of my first big events was at it's called Nyack Library in Rockland County, if anyone knows where that is. So it was an interesting experience for me because I grew up in Brooklyn, but I lived for a while, in the end of my teenage years. I lived in Rockland County, and so I was invited to speak there. And one of the questions that I got from a person who I think is still like a very, like someone who lived in the Hasidic community not far from there. And he asked me a question, do you believe in God? So I asked him, what do you mean by that? Define belief, define God. What do you mean by that? Do you believe in God? And he's like, this is a yes or no question. Do you believe in God? Yes or no? So I told him, listen, if belief to you is a yes or no question, then my answer is no. I don't believe or relate to anything that's clear-cut and that's as dry as you try to put it on. So I think I am comfortable today in the kind of this like in between, in this ambiguous and almost contradictory state where people, I have had times when I led a service, a very religious one, and the same weekend I spoke at a conference of American atheists. I have no issue with that. I don't see any contradiction in that, and I feel extremely comfortable in that. I think I can only enjoy the parts of my background, the parts of religion, the parts of our tradition that I enjoy because I let myself rebel when I need to rebel. I let myself reject what I need to reject. So to give a very short, it's going to sound long, but it's actually really short as opposed to what the actual answer would be, answer to such a question, it's philosophically, I'm still very much comfortable with using atheism as a label sometimes, at least from a philosophical point of view where God is that creature or existence or being that is outside of the universe that has created everything, almost like God is like a coder who has created a program, which is very much what in a philosophical world would be called the Abrahamic God. I don't believe in that. I don't relate to that. At the same time, when we're going to talk about God as, if you want to use God as a word for a sum total of existence, for a unifying force, for an energy, for a force to relate to, for a divine existence, I love it. I relate to it. I wouldn't use the word believe again because I have a lot of not so positive connotations with the word belief. But I definitely, it's something that I relate to. At the same time, I am proudly Jewish, celebrated in many, many ways. If you check out my Facebook or any social media, probably half of my tweets are either about very Jewish or very like angry on religion, but it's at least there and it's very much part of my life. I've also found ways of using my tradition, and I think everyone could do that. I'm going to use a specific example, but I think everyone could find ways in their own, whatever they grew up with, whether it's a religion or a culture, that relates to that. So for me, for example, 4 years ago, I was going through a very hard period. It was right after I started school, which for me, I promised myself that if I'm going to get into a really good school, all these like BS about gender is just going to go away and everything is just going to be perfect. And I got to the realization that nothing is magically becoming better. And I didn't know what, I was dealing with depression in a very bad way. I hope that's okay if I talk about that. Is yeah. Everyone okay if I talk about it? I'm just always make sure that no one, okay. And what happened was I was at a point sometimes where I would just not do anything for weeks. Like whatever it was, like stay home when I had to be home. Even if I would go to class, it would go like getting my backpack, going to class, usually not talk anything in class, and then coming back. And even the homework that I would do, I would rather do at home than even go to the library. And if anyone here went to Columbia or Barnard? So yeah, you probably know that Butler is not the most social place to go, which is our main library. And I still wouldn't even want to go there because I don't want to talk to anyone. And I was really afraid of myself of what's going to happen. And one of the things that I took on then that I still do, that I think kind of saved me and helped me keep me grounded was that every Friday night I light candles, which is a traditional thing that Jews across religious observances still do in many places. And I have to do something. I force myself to either go to a service, whatever I believed in it or felt like it or not, or go to a Shabbat, to a Friday night dinner, forcing myself to do that. Now, in a very strong way, just it was part of my tradition, part of my religion that I held on to it. But the reason I did it was because it was a really good mental health exercise. It's something that kept me grounded. And I have that with a lot of other things. I love holidays, for example. I think holidays, besides the fact that they're fun, and I know there's a joke about Jewish holidays, that every Jewish holiday, if someone tried to kill us, they failed, let's have a party, which is to some extent accurate, but it's beautiful. But even besides the food, I found it as an experience of a time when I get to an excuse to celebrate with friends. I personally, I love to cook. So it's a good excuse to cook up a storm without feeling guilty for maybe not cooking the most healthy food, because, hey, this is the traditional food, so I have to do that. I have to make this really oily, like, fried dough because this is what we eat. What could I do? I think we can use and look at that. And I think it came up also when I had my initial conversation with you, of like, how do we look at things that have been around for hundreds and thousands of years and make it our own? How do we sometimes twist it, sometimes take it out of context, and sometimes turn it upside down? But as I've said in the beginning, that's beautiful, and doing that is what I've been doing for the last 3 years in a very strong way. Does that even answer your question? I feel like I went on a rant and then like didn't even get to answer the question.
Thank you. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you a specific question because Abby's compiled so much amazing research, pulling out specific quotes and passages from the Torah, from Talmudic texts, from Kabbalah. And in reading a lot of the research that you've done or that you've compiled, it's interesting because one phenomenon that comes up a lot, for example, in Isaac, who until I had looked at some of what you pulled out, I had no idea that Isaac was born apparently with the soul of a female. That's not...
Should I maybe read that text so people
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to read a text that we're all, again, it's going to be in the handout later. And then I will let you finish. Yeah. People know what we're talking about. So this is a text from a book that was published in the 18th century. It's the first generation of Hasidic teachers. It has a personal meaning to me that I can talk a bit about later, but I'm just going to read through it. It is known that when Isaac was born, he was born with the soul of a female. That's a tradition that goes back to the 13th century, at least. As it is written in Orach Chaim, and through the Akaida, which is the story of the binding of Isaac, he got a male soul that can influence. With that, we can understand why they are more infertile humans than animals, even though they both got, I don't know if that's scientifically accurate, but that's what I said. even though they both got the same blessing, it will not be within you and within your animal's infertility. That refers to a biblical verse after the creation where God is promising the world that there wouldn't be within you and your animal's infertility. But why is it that there are so many infertile humans? It's because of the way souls work. But this is known, according to the secret, the mysticism of reincarnation, that at times a female would be in a male body. Because in the reason of reincarnation, the soul of a female would come to be in a male. That is not a 21st century gender theory, radical, liberal ideology. It's something that was written in the mid-18th century. And if you take away one thing from this whole quote, at times, female would be in a male body. And the same the other way around.
So my question was, that is obviously as interesting and radical as it is to hear that that was written in the 18th century. It also does subscribe to, you know, a binary gender idea. And you've also done a lot of other research into evidence of kind of people who are gender deviant, gender nonconforming, to examples of people who are intersex being in religious texts. And yeah, I just wanted to hear you, I guess, talk a little bit more about these kind of different types of gender nonconformity that are being kind of charted out. In. And if you see them in contradiction, or if you just take it as a given that religious texts will be full of contradiction.
Can I read another text, actually, before I respond to that? Mm-hmm. Let's see if I find it. Here. Okay, so this is from something called a Midrash. Midrash is a collection of rabbinic writings and teachings that were never intended to be taken on face value. They were always, I don't know an English word for that. English is my fourth language, FYI, so if I'm blanking on a word, you can't blame me. What do you use for a word? Not fan fiction,
what
but
are you
like
trying to say?
Midrash. I'm trying to like find a way of explaining it of like how the rabbis are using it as something where they know that it's not necessarily real. Folklore. Yeah, very folklore is a good, but using folklore as a way of interpreting the Bible to some extent. So this is an interpretation on the story of creation, where it's that God created a person. So, and God said, let us make Adam. Let us make the first human in our image, in our shape. When God created God created the first human, he was created as both genders. Thus it is written, male and female, he created them. Which is a very interesting verse, which is literally in Genesis 1:27. It says, and God created man in his own image, and the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. It's mixing up plural and singular. When God created the first human, he created, and other rabbis saying that when God created the first human, he created him with two faces, one on each side. Humanity was literally two-faced from the beginning. And then when he made Eve, he split him along the middle, forming two backs, one side. So like, I guess the first human had like two fronts and like two heads to some extent. And then God just went, so like, I guess you could say it was both genders. Or in the same way, you can actually argue, which is another thing that I've been focused a bit lately, is that ultimately what that is saying, because the way we look on gender, and specifically in a binary way, is you need to have an opposite to compare it to. So like, men are identified with having stuff that women don't, or having, or the same the other way around. It's like one against the other. So if there's just one person who has everything, then it's not just that person is both genders, just genderless. Gender didn't really exist. It wasn't really an object. It wasn't anything that anyone spoke about. But what's interesting to me, though, is that that is followed up by another teaching. Another rabbi is saying, when God created the first human, he created him as a lifeless mass, able to reach from one end to the other. Thus it is written, your eyes saw a mass. Now, while this translates as mass, the word that's used in Hebrew for that, which is actually also part of English, but now golem, it became an English word. It's originally Hebrew, which means this like dummy that doesn't understand anything. And to me, that like the ultimate message is that when it comes to gender, and it's the way I look on that in history, on text, we don't know anything. Ultimately, it's one big mess that we're all trying to make sense of it. And that's what humanity has been doing for thousands of years. One of the most common arguments that I hear against transgender and non-binary people and so on is the question of, oh, it must be something that is a result of Hollywood and the media and the liberal blah, 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 which is the reason why it's all there. Because if it was real, where were all the trans people 100 years ago? Where were you 1,000 years ago and so on? So now, besides the fact that Hollywood didn't influence me, because by the time I watched the first Hollywood movie, I was already queer AF.
It's great. How old were you when you watched... when you saw your first Hollywood movie?
The first movie that I ever saw was actually Magic Mike. I was 21 years old. And I think
good
you
movie.
Were the one who was shaking on Rockland. Do you know Rockland County? Oh, you were the one to know? So I went to Palisades Mall on a Saturday afternoon. And that's the first time I watched the movie. But anyway, I mean to say, like, me, myself, and like I run a whole support group for people who come from fundamentalist backgrounds, and none of us have been influenced by the liberal media, and we all have the feelings that we have. But besides that, the very simple response to that is that it did exist throughout history. I mean, why we don't see it that much? I mean, just look on the world today. I mean, the world today still isn't as welcoming as we should be to the LGBTQ community. So obviously even when I started out in 2012, it was a lot harder than it is today. And try to imagine anyone trying to be queer before Stonewall, and it was a different world, and forget about it 100 years ago. Yet, which makes it even so much stronger, that almost in every culture that we have recorded writings or stories from, you find it. Whatever it's Greek and Roman and ancient Mesopotamian, ancient Asian narratives, and then forget it, like Native Americans just had it all the time until the Europeans came and messed it up like we do with everything. It was always around. So the way I see all of these texts is I like to focus less on the exact details, because some of them, like there are texts in mysticism that try to explain why someone would have the wrong or the opposite soul, and they use some homophobic words of explaining it. I don't know if you saw that online. So like I don't like to focus as much on the exact details of it, unless if you want to do a scholarly like study of it, which I love. But as a whole, it just shows that it was something that was always here. There's a text that it's not in here because it was very long, and I sometimes care about the environment, so it would literally take up a whole other paper. But it's online, which is a writing from a 13th century poet. And he's by chance Jewish, but it really doesn't matter. It's someone who goes into describing their feelings, and it sounds like a coming out video from a trans person explaining how they want to be a woman. And one of the cursed be the one who told to my father it's a boy, and finishes with a long prayer. I wish they could just wake up as a woman. And so on. And there's so many of these texts. And what they just show me is that was something that they grapple with. It's something that they were trying to understand. What do we do with all of these feelings? And then, which is how we got all of that, which is how we have Jewish law that until it got corrupted around the 5th to 6th century was constantly talking about at least 6 different genders. We have mystic teachings that go into detail of how there's a whole book called Shara Gulgalim, which means the doors to reincarnation, that goes into talking with exact details of how souls work, and gender there is as fluid as it gets, and so on. So the way I just see it is the simply human experience, which is again what we have discussed in the beginning. It's simply art where we trying. It's like just like art is a way of expressing themselves to them, and just like to any writer. Writing is a form of art, specifically in the folklore. This was a way of trying to explore their own thing. And I think when it comes to namings, that's a very similar experience of trying to make sense of ourselves. I know for me it was like, how do you, a name ultimately is a one word you. It's like, you know, I hate even when I have to do like a one sentence bio, which happens a lot in my work. And I even hate one sentence. I'm like, how do I put it into one sentence? But ultimately a name is putting it into one word. And I mean, I think the reason why we have mostly gendered names, which when you think about it, doesn't make any sense. Like, why do we need gendered names? I mean, clothing we can maybe argue about, but names? I mean, I think it's getting more and more. We have gender-neutral names, but then I'm also guilty. I chose a very feminine name. But it's ultimately our attempt to make sense, and that's all just what I think. I'm not a psychologist. I don't understand everything, and it's all just based on a bit of the scholarship that I know. Hello, where are you? I think ultimately a name is our attempt to make sense of ourselves in one word, if that makes sense.
Which may be an impossible.
Oh, I think it's impossible, but that doesn't stop people from trying to build. Building binaries for gender or sexuality is impossible also, yet hasn't stopped humanity from doing that. So, you know.
Yeah, I was thinking when I was in the process of, I guess, had just started going by the name Cyrus, Haley, who loves to email me at strange hours of the day, many quotes from the Torah and other. Yeah. sent me this. I guess you were kind of thinking a lot about the Tower of Babel. And Haley sent me this passage from Genesis that I actually wrote down, where, you know, Earth's people decide to build a tower. I'll read the quote. Then they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower."
What'd you say? I'm just saying it in Hebrew.
Do you want to say a line and then you can say it in Hebrew?
No.
Okay. Then they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens so that we may make a name for ourselves. Otherwise, we will be scattered over the face of the whole earth." And then God was really displeased with this attempt at coherence and reaching towards the heavens and all of the kind of ego that went along with this kind of grandiose act of naming. So then God destroyed the tower and scattered all of Earth's people throughout the world. And in doing so, also split up the one language that all of Earth's people had spoken, and then was the confusion of tongues, and humans were destined to speak infinite languages and never understand each other ever again. But I think about that passage in particular so much because something in a way felt so, and it's interesting because I didn't grow up in a religious household, and I still so often find myself kind of clinging on to biblical passages as some kind of anchor for myself. But there's something so freeing to me about the particular story of Babel, because there's this, you know, Earth's people say, we want to have a name, we want to have a single name, we want to have this single tower that reaches towards God. And God is like, you can't have that level of coherence. And there's kind of, or like, there's this kind of scattering that happens. And I think that it makes me think a lot about how even in naming myself or naming anything, maybe the goal isn't actually permanence or something, but just kind of accepting that there will always be some kind of scattering or some kind of like destruction or kind of like infinite change and infinite transformation, and that we can only just try to state who we are in the moment and accept that may be fleeting too.
That's a very interesting observation. I don't think I've ever thought about it necessarily that way, but yeah, I mean,
I'd like to hear your, I'm sure you have many and different readings.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like from the way I grew up with that story, like the bigger problem wasn't as much as the fact that they were trying to pick a name, but rather the fact that they were trying to reach to that. They're trying to reach the heavens to some extent. There was actually, before when there was the whole space race, there was a big rabbi in Brooklyn who claimed that, God is never, they're never going to reach the moon because God would never allow it, because look in the biblical story. And there's also like a traditional ritual that the Jews do, which is totally left over from paganism. It's just so obvious that once a month, so the moon, there's a new moon every month, right? We all see that. So after 7 days, so between the 7th and the 15th day of the month, every month, one of the nights you go outside and you say like a blessing to the moon, which is very much worshiping the moon, but that's most likely a leftover from paganism. But one of the things that you say that then is you try to jump, and you're like, just like I can't, I try to jump and I can't reach you, so my enemies shouldn't be able to reach me. So it was like, hey, it's very clear you can't reach the moon, blah, blah, blah. But obviously, unless you believe all the conspiracy theories, we most likely did reach the moon. but it is a very interesting and very, very keen observation, like that, like, trying to make a name for yourself. I mean, I also would want to think of like how that relates to a group of people trying to create one name for a whole group. Mm. It's like them coming and being like, we all have to fit into this one name. It's like creating a box of like our culture. Hey, everyone has to fit into this. I think that is also a big part. But you're right. It is a very interesting observation. Our names definitely change. And I like the fact, I sometimes try to look on certain religious customs the same way I study public policy, and I try to look at it the same way I would look on laws, on specifically policy laws, and even sometimes the Constitution. And one of the things that's always the most interesting to me is the fact that the people who wrote this law, so take the Constitution, for example, they wrote these, and if you know history, like it went back and forward, and they wrote first the Federalist Papers, and they're like again and again, they were like, sorry, not the Federalist Papers, but the Articles of Confederation, and then like they were fighting back and forward, and like it took them such a long time to came up with these like principles, these 10 amendments in the beginning, and then still felt the need to put in a way in it on how to change it. Which came from a very clear understanding that as much as we are trying to make it perfect, there has to be a way of changing it. When I look on at least our culture, and I think most cultures have a way and a ritual of how to change a name, not just for babies. Like in Judaism, it comes up a lot for sick people. There's this custom of changing names for sick people or adding names. There is in something that's, I think, less practiced, at least I haven't seen people practicing it, but changing your name to change your luck. Like all of these things are, and as much as naming is a big deal, we get, as you've said at the beginning, we get that name when we are born. It's our attachment to our families. There's still an understanding that we need to have a ritual. We need to have a formula in place on how to change that.
What is the, can you speak a little bit more about this renaming in sickness?
It's actually not such a, it's a very common procedure. It's still done a lot, at least where I grew up, and I see it a lot. It's done a lot in renewal communities, and I know a lot of, I've done a, throughout my, the interfaith work that I've been doing, I know several, Christian ministers that's almost a big thing that they do, where people come to them and they do a naming, which is again, it comes back to this understanding that a name is who you are, a name is your soul. So in part of the ritual, you say like a blessing, and part of that literally says, if the verdict is out on this and this person with this and this name, that they have to die, this is now a new person with a different name, and they don't have to die. It's almost like negotiating with God. Hey, you think that person A has to die? Fine, but this is not person A anymore. And to some extent, it's like what you said before also, it's like looking, oh, that first person is dead now. It's like getting rid of that person. And now, and that is literally the wording that you say as part of that ritual. Mm-hmm. Which is, again, coming back to that very strong sense of we are our names, and but though it's not set in stone, yes, we can mess around with them, we can change them, and sometimes we have to change them.
Well, we have to wrap it up a little, but...
Oh, wow. That was a beautiful note to end on.
Yeah, but yeah, we're going to open it up to questions, if anyone has any.
Pronouns they, them. Rachel is under negotiation. it's a on point topic. I mean, I'm curious. It goes right off of what you guys were just talking about, but there's like an obvious tension between a theory of self that involves a cut or a rupture or a death, and like the idea of past selves, and then one that involves continuity and like, you know, accumulation and accretion and growth and like a palimpsest, and there, and like just from like a psych point of view, sorry Rachel, there I've like found utility in both of those kinds of theories, and I'm wondering how all of you negotiate that kind of tension, particularly like when it's useful for you and how it's been less useful.
I'm thinking like years ago, I don't know how long, maybe 5 or 6 years ago or something, 4 or 5. I saw a video of this person who maybe some of you know about named Westerly Windina, who's a surfer, an Australian surfer. She's a trans femme surfer who was formerly like a worldwide surf champion, really kind of beautiful person. And she lives in Queensland, and it was just this short video of her just kind of surfing and talking about her life and her history. My father showed me the video, and in the video she talks about her former identity in the third person. She uses the name and uses he pronouns, talks about his name, and says things like, talks about the pain that he was in. He says, you know, he suffered in these ways. He was so lonely. He hurt so much. And it really scared me. The video really, really freaked me out. I think just to see that level of this cut, this rupture, it made me feel so scared. And I thought to myself, it felt unimaginable. And I remember thinking, and at that time, there were definitely glimmers of knowing that my future held a lot of change and having visions of what that change would look like, but visions that were really scary and often had to be pushed down. But I was like, I could, you know, it seemed unimaginable. And now it just in this natural way, I think about myself in the past, and that's how it happens to me all the time. I'll notice my thoughts inside my head. I'll use, the third person, and I'll use she pronouns. And it's a way of almost feeling like I'm taking care of someone that was suffering, who I was, and who's sort of still there, but who I have to protect or something. And I guess, as with all things, it doesn't have to be one or the other, this continuity or this cut. But I will say that the farther I get into this version of myself, the more and more I actually have a type of love and compassion for earlier versions of myself. And because it's often so much easier to love and have compassion for other people, I notice myself needing to turn who I was into another entity in order to be able to love her and protect her in some way.
I mean, I can say much about it. I think we've, and ultimately the answer is, it's a never-ending struggle, I think, to some extent. But it's interesting to me to hear you talk about your relationship to your older self, because, and I've had it more than once, specifically on TV, to just love doing that, like show me pictures of my past, and like, how do you relate to that? And weirdly enough, when I look on pictures of my past, I also have this slight disconnect. To me, it feels a bit like I'm looking at my brother, besides the fact that it actually looks like my brother, but it just feels this like it doesn't feel like me. I don't have an emotional connection to it. I look at it and I'm like, yeah, whatever. Though when I look on pictures when I was younger, like really like a baby, I do connect to that a lot more. And pardon my like self, congratulation, or I don't know what the word is, but like I think I was a beautiful baby. So I really like it. And like, I actually have pictures. My mom dressed me up twice over Purim, which is like our Halloween, dressed me up like a girl. And I love looking at it and I do relate to it. And that's from that was way before other pictures and other stuff that I did that I don't relate to. I just took out of storage a lot of my writing from the time that I was in yeshiva in rabbinical school. And it's weird. Most of them, I'm reading them, and I'm like, interesting. Who said that? Oh, that was me. Oh, sorry. Like, even to the stuff that I wrote, the things that I did at that point, they don't feel like me. The part where that freaks me out a bit is sometimes I'm afraid that if I will start feeling a disconnect to, I have a son that was born 7 years ago, and I'm like terrified. Thankfully, that hasn't happened. If I will start feeling a disconnect, because that's a result of that other time period where the person that I was when he was born, I don't relate to, but somehow he feels like my kid very, very much, regardless of where I was at that point. So, yeah, I think there's no, I wish there was a yes or no answer to a question like that. I don't know if one. Could be there is. I don't know.
Thank you all for sharing. Cyrus, I'm curious to hear more about your liminal year with no name, as you put it. I'm thinking about the violence of naming and the violence of language for that matter, and wondering if that year felt like an escape from language or a space of play, verbally speaking, or if it felt, or if you felt illegible or had difficulty navigating that. I'm curious from like a linguistic standpoint what that felt like in terms of moving between or outside of naming.
It's funny. I feel like I always am having to go to just like little events and meetings with name tags, you know. And you go and you write your name tag, or maybe someone would make the name tag ahead of time for you. And there was like a period of a few months, maybe half a year, where any time I would go to an event where there was a name tag, I would immediately throw my name tag out. And then people would be like, where's your name tag? And I'd be like, oh, they didn't make me a name tag. And then they'd be like, what's your name? And I'd be like, well, I don't have a name tag. So like just this weird like tautology where I would basically, instead of having to use a name, I would say that I was a person who didn't have a name tag, and it would just get really awkward. And they'd, well, do you want a name tag? Or, oh, there's no more name tags. Or something like that. And so it requires a lot of funny tricks. And I noticed I would always, it made me, first off, I didn't have any social media at that time because I just didn't want to have to see any kind of proof in writing of myself. I also felt really uncomfortable going out and being social or going and doing anything in public. This is the first time I've, you know, sat in front of a room of people since I started hormones and got this surgery that was significant for me. I did one thing at the very beginning of just having changed my name, but it felt so scary, and half the people in the room were calling me my old name and half the people in the room were calling me my new name, and I was constantly worried about making sure that the people from my past didn't get scared when they found out I had a new name, and then making sure that the people who knew me as my new name didn't find out I had an old name. And then, you know, meeting someone and then getting in a lift and then them saying my old name and feeling like a con artist and being like, I'm part of a legacy of men who have gone to new cities and pretended to be someone they're not, and I'm just a big con artist and that kind of thing. And it's, and one thing that's been really relieving and nice to talk to friends about who have gone, and at this point I have friends who have changed their names 5, 6, 7 times, you know, and I'm so excited for I'm so excited to change my name every decade. I really want to mark each decade with a new name. But it was so relieving to me when I realized that I wasn't alone in feeling like it's just so scary and humiliating to have a new name, and every single time it feels like a lie. And I've also started to be like, no wonder I always felt like such a liar. Because every time I said my old name, in a way I was lying. And I think for so long I believed I was just destined to lie all the time. And it's taking a lot for me every time I say, hello, I'm Cyrus, to not feel like I'm telling a lie. And having to release a lot of shame around this idea of lying and being like, I wasn't actually given the tools to be honest. And I have to I have to relearn that and teach myself what that looks like. But I think it was also just linguistically, it was really interesting for me to at certain moments be like, I'm falling asleep and I don't feel that I have a name and I don't feel that I have a gender. Do I even exist? And that being just terrifying and feeling like I was just utterly in a void. And also being like, I should cherish that I could have moments of feeling this disparate and dissipated, and maybe one with just the fact that, you know, my individuality actually is fleeting and temporary and in a lot of ways isn't real. And there are special things about getting to kind of access the chaos of feeling like no one or something.
Is there anyone else that has a question?
But also, you don't have to answer this question because I don't know if it's too personal, and it's for Cyrus. And Eve, you were talking about your name being your grandmother's name. Okay, but and it was also her name too, or I don't.
So it's on my ID on my license and then whatever I use it, I don't use it much. It's my middle name is Chava, which is the Hebrew version of Eve, and it was my great-great-grandmother's name. Yeah. I had to go, I mean, to some extent I would have had to go that far anyway because I have 8 sisters and most of them have 2 names, so while we all name after grandparents, so most of them were taken, so to speak. Yeah.
That's so beautiful, that connection to deep family. And I guess I'm wondering, and you don't have to answer this question, of course, but talking about linguistics and maybe origins and where that name, how you choose a name. I'm really interested in changing my name. Like, and I have a name that I have been called that's not so gender specific, but it's very hard to, I understand this, like, it's so hard to move. Especially when you have any kind of public life, and I don't know how to, you know, but I guess I'm wondering about how you like
Cyrus,
how you pick it, and also like the name Cyrus. To me, it's like the word sigh is in it, which is a kind of breath of release and relief, and I love that there at the end of the struggle is this sigh.
Well, I go get coffee, I go sigh, C-Y. Or essay, but then I'm like, who's going to think my name is Sigh, S-I-G-H, but honestly, kind of cool name. So, I don't mind. It's funny because we've been talking so much about names as loyalty and names, in terms of how they relate to family, but I feel like I have this piece of paper, this green piece of paper that my parents made when they were choosing names for me when I was little. And it's tons and tons of girls' names, like things like I could have been Myrna, I could have been Esther. There was a lot of things that could have happened, and we're all grateful that they didn't happen. love those names, but that would have been challenging for me. but there was one, the name Cyrus was I thought for a long time that Cyrus was the only name under the boy column, but I recently found out that Lewis was also a possibility, which, you know, when I hit, when my 30s come, so I always loved the name Cyrus, and I would look at this, my mother framed this green piece of paper, and I would look at the name Cyrus so lustfully, and I even would look at it and imagine this person who was like, you know, tall, pale, there's some similarities, kind of broad-shouldered, flat-chested. A lot of times he was like on a beach in a blue Speedo. I don't know why. And I would just imagine this man named Cyrus, and I would think about him and like fall asleep at night imagining him kind of like diving into water, just like this guardian. It's like we all know who I was thinking about. But I just lusted after the name, but I was like, even I would have these weird thoughts like, maybe someday I'll meet a man named Cyrus, you know, or something like that. Like, just because, just these weird thoughts. And then at some point I was like, oh, I'm Cyrus. and then it was like putting on it just immediately, I just felt this feeling wash over me of like, the day that I remembered, because I had to dig it up. I woke up one morning and I remembered. And then I also love that. I mean, I love who Cyrus is biblically. And then I also love that the name, one of the meanings for the name Cyrus is young and farsighted. So it kind of means this naivete. Yeah. And that felt really right for me in terms of thinking about rebirth, and reconnecting with myself as a child and being like, no, I am young, and I get to be farsighted and young and naive, and I get to be a baby again, maybe.
Do you want this?
A hypothetical question. Sorry, just okay. Here's the thing, actually. If you're asking by like Jewish law, so just for a quick context for people who don't get it, I'm in Judaism. There are still families that are keeping track of being priests, which are descendants of the biblical Aaron, and the same as Levites, which are descendants of the biblical tribe of Levi. There actually are scientific evidence, specifically genetic ones, that do link. Most of the people that have a tradition that they are descendants of Aaron, they do seem to all trace their Y haplogroup. For anyone who knows how genetic testing works, they do tend to trace their kind of like patrilineal line to one person. So we're not going to go into the whole whatever it is, historical or not. But so the way that works, it goes from father to son forever. So by Jewish law, changing your name doesn't affect that, and you can't give it up. There's no such a thing. As far as the law is concerned, you're born with it and that's it. Changing a name it's not even considered mystical in Judaism. And the last name has nothing to do with that, because last names in Judaism are relatively new. It's just that when they have to take last names, a lot of people who were descendants of priests took a name that was related to that, like Katz, is the combination of two words, which means in Hebrew righteous priest. My grandmother on my father's side is Kahana, which is also people come from them. Cohen, all of these people are part of the priestly families, but it's not a requirement. There's a lot of people who come from priestly families that their last name doesn't mean anything. So that's it's an interesting question. I never thought about that much, and I like that you bring it up because it does make me think about it. But as far as the letter of the law is concerned, it has no effect on it.
Is there any last questions?
It's actually very interesting, and I think a bit about it. I have a few like weird obsessions, and I think every person is allowed to, right? For me, one of them is genealogy. So it's not the same as genetic testing. It's genealogy through like studying them. The amount of time I've spent in genealogy libraries could have written a few more books doing that. Anyway, but I learned something very interesting, which was that my great-grandmother's name, her maiden name was Twersky. For anyone who knows the rabbinic dynasties, they are legitimately the biggest Hasidic dynasty in the Jewish world is the Twersky family. So that was my great-grandmother's family. And I learned that apparently my grandfather, whose last name was Stein, and that's how we all knew him, as when he came out, his papers, because he came out to, like, his father-in-law who was already living here and got him, like, immigration documents, whatever the whole story was. So his name that I found the records, it wasn't through Ellis Island, but I found the immigration records, and it was a different name. And it was interesting because I did know growing up, the story that I have heard was that for a long time, his father-in-law, my great-great-grandfather, was always pushing him that he thinks he should take on that name because that was considered a more prestigious name and whatever. So he wanted them to take on that name. And my grandfather always resisted, saying that there's almost no one left from this family. Like, with our last name, Stein, we are one of the only... We are, like, his kids, my grandfather's kids, are pretty much the only branch of the family that's left out of a family that had hundreds of... Apparently, I don't know if the number is accurate, but we were told that 70 of our of my grandfather's direct family were killed in Babi Yar, which was during the Holocaust when, like, whatever, there was a big massacre in Ukraine. And he always claimed that this is the only part that's left for my family. I'm not giving up on it. And then it was interesting for me to see that kind of the other part of that story was that when he needed it, when he needed to escape, he did end up using a different name. And I don't know if he ever thought about it, but to me it was interesting. And now, like, you're asking that, it's because my grandfather was definitely trying to use that name to almost hold on to trauma in a positive way to some extent, but hold on to the fact that I can't change my name because I'm the last person left of that family that was all killed. It's similar to what we were talking from the beginning, like almost this guilt feeling that comes attached with it, but in a bit of a positive way. I definitely think another tradition that we also have, for example, is that while we name after ancestors, which I think is a fairly common custom even outside of Jewish communities, right? I think, I don't know. But for us, we always name. So there's this like fight that happened after the Holocaust, which was for people that are named after people that were killed in the Holocaust, should we give the names to begin with? And if we do, usually, for example, if someone dies really young, you add a name to it. So it wouldn't be, because again, the names are the soul and someone's the luck and so on. And there was this whole fight after the Holocaust because it was an unprecedented experience for probably any group of humanity ever. So it was something that they had to figure out. And some people argued that, hey, this is a traumatic thing. People were killed in the most brutal ways. And you don't want to give these names without changing that. But at the same time, there was other community leaders who were, no, we got to remember these people the way they are, the way they were. And naming is a big part. Almost any Holocaust memorial that I've been to, names are some of the biggest parts of it. And it's not just Holocaust memorials. Go down to the 9/11 memorial, and it's the names. And so there was always this, and it was very interesting for me because both my oldest sister is named after my great-grandmother that was killed, and my mother is named after my great-great-grandmother that was also killed. And for my mother, my mother's name is just the name of her great-grandmother without any additions, because the rabbi, the person that they asked when she was born, believed that you got to it's like passing on the trauma as it is. And then when my sister was born, my father went to ask his rabbi, and he said he should add a name. So she ended up with three names. And it was a big conversation. I think we're running out of time, so I'm going to stop here. But I can talk with you later, and there was a lot of – it's very interesting because there's a lot of writings. It's like – I mean, there was a lot of literature who obviously came out from the Holocaust, but that became a big topic of, like, how does passing on these names to our kids – is it positive? Is it negative? How do we do that? But I'd really like the question. Thank you.
Thanks to all of you for coming.
Also, where are these? Are they in the back? Okay, so are you going to hand them out? Okay, good. Also, I don't remember who it was. There was someone who took a video. I just want to make sure. Yeah, send it to me. That's all. Okay, good. Or post it and tag me, whatever you want.